You're listening to the Podcast Network. Listen, learn, evolve.
There's a way, such a better way. Today, today. Raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today, there's a better way. Ooh, there's a way, such a better way. Today, today. Now raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. The way is the Adam's way.
This is Rod Adams, and it's time for Atomic Show number 115. And with me tonight is a terrific group of people. First is Ted Rockwell, who's been directly involved in nuclear power for over 60 years, starting in 1943 as a process improvement task force at the atomic bomb project at Oak Ridge, Tennessee. He was Admiral Rickover's technical director for a number of years, and he's got all kinds of experience. Also, Robert Margolis, who is a professional nuclear engineer, and Kelly Taylor, who has 21 years in the nuclear industry in various positions of technical expertise. Welcome to all of you.
Thanks, Rod.
Yep.
Hi, Rod. Thanks for the opportunity.
And I'll let each of you introduce yourself in your own voice so people can kind of sort out who's talking when.
Well, okay. Then I guess I'll go first. This is Kelly Taylor, and I should be the easiest voice to pick out on the podcast.
This is Robert Margolis.
Hi, and this is Ted Rockwell. And all of us, I think, are ready to talk at a drop of a hat. So, Rod, drop a hat.
Okay, well, I'll drop the hat. And one of the main focuses for tonight's show is a article that Ted just got published in Nuclear News. And the title of the article is one that should intrigue folks. It is Nuclear Energy, Not a Faustian Bargain, But a Near-Perfect Providential Gift. And in that article, one of the things that Ted is trying to do, and remember this is in Nuclear News written to the nuclear industry, he's trying to tell people that it's time to stop trying to say that nuclear has unique risks when it has the best safety record of any available energy alternative.
Okay, why don't you take off from there, Rod?
Absolutely.
Okay. I think part of the problem is that at the very beginning, there was a group that was trying to build something in nuclear power, namely Rickover and his gang, who had a specific product in mind they were trying to produce. But the nuclear business was in the hands of scientists, not engineers. And scientists, like lawyers, don't get paid for solving problems. They get paid for working on problems. So while we were trying to avoid problems or solving them if we couldn't avoid them, they were busily creating problems. So we were producing ships and reactors in them, and the scientific community was creating the China syndrome, the guillotine break, the terrible nuclear waste problem, all that stuff. None of those problems were created by an anxious public or by anti-nukes. We created all of those because each of these problems, as you create, the more mysterious it is and the more difficult it is, the easier the grant money flows. And this is no great conspiracy theory. I mean, you know, there aren't people sitting in a room organizing this. It's just the natural way that the system works, and the individuals involved aren't evil. They're just trying to get their piece of the action. But what happened was, if you look at the problems that nuclear has, you find that they are just a reverse twist on what are actually advantages. I mean, imagine we've got the only waste in the world that gets less and less toxic all by itself every day, even if you don't do anything about it. And they managed to make this an unprecedented problem. So you say, well, why is it an unprecedented problem? Well, because it stays toxic for millions of years. Well, what's the story on all the other non-radioactive things? Oh, yeah, they stay toxic forever. You know, all the heavy metals and all of those things, arsenic, mercury, lead, all that, those things. And so what we have is a whole bunch of problems, in quotes, which have never hurt anybody. So, you know, people are telling Obama that one of the first things he's going to have to do is to take on this problem of solving the nuclear waste problem. And I say, wait a minute, let's go back. How do you define a problem, a public problem that's so important that he should give it priority over all these other things that we're besieged with? And if it's a problem that has never hurt anybody and never hurt the environment, that's as a result of hundreds of reactors being run for decades now. And in addition, you can show theoretically that it is not possible to have the kind of a catastrophe that people are predicting. And we've demonstrated that. We've made this point. It's been published. It's been circulated. Nobody has denied it. And people go on talking about these problems that you can demonstrate simply cannot happen.
Well, I think that provides an incredible opportunity for what people in the consulting world call a quick win. Obama could solve the nuclear waste problem simply by recognizing and declaring that it is not a problem.
Well, that's the fact. Let me tell you what the Navy is now doing with, quote, all that nuclear waste. They're doing nothing, absolutely nothing. They're making cores, reactor cores, that last the life of a ship, which is an unspecified number of decades, but informally described as a million miles of operation, 40 times around the world. And at the end of that 40 times, what have they done with the nuclear waste? Nothing. And where is it? It's still in the fuel elements. It's such a tiny quantity of material that it is embedded in the interstices of the fuel element. So when the ship is completed its mission, the reactor is taken out of it and sent where good reactors go to be either ultimately used again or not. But in any case, there has been no nuclear waste either sent anywhere or released to the environment or anything else. It's just sitting where it was born in the core, which shows the magnitude of the problem. It's completely trivial.
Yeah, all that waste from all of those ships is sitting in one location, and it's not even a very big place.
Well, and you know, the public never raised a big issue about the nuclear waste, the spent fuel, or I should say used fuel, sitting in casks at the plants. The public never saw that as a problem. Sheldon Novick, for instance, the author of The Careless Atom, one of the really active anti-nukes, says nuclear waste is no more dangerous than a lot of other industrial waste, and it's sitting there in incredibly high integrity containment, just sitting there not hurting anybody. And the nuclear industry had to create the fear in the public that we've got to get this dreadful stuff out of here. And what happens when you get it out of here? You put it on the road. It is then announced that these are mobile Chernobyls. They're talking about putting a billion miles into making a road out in the desert somewhere to keep these casks from going by schools and churches, because you wouldn't want nuclear waste going by schools and churches. So they're talking about a 300-mile road, an offshoot, to avoid this. And this is stuff that there's no way you could make it hurt anybody.
Having seen the casks, I've got to agree with you. It's not like it's melting into the groundwater or causing, you know, contamination of even the dirt underneath it. It's a non-issue. They sit there in very high integrity cans, but cans nonetheless just sit there. You know,
right.
They're
not actually
in the wintertime, and they're not going anywhere.
That's right, and they've actually put in quite a bit of effort into seeing what it is that you could make a problem out of these, which is a legitimate thing to do. And it turns out that these casks are so strong and such high integrity that the only thing they've found that can make a dent in them is a shape charge, high efficiency, special armor penetrating shell. And if you strap one of those on a special rig so that it centers up very carefully on the center line of the reactor so it won't just skid off the surface, you can get one to penetrate and drive about a 3-inch hole on one side. It doesn't even come out the other side. And you knock out a few of these pieces of ceramic and they fall to the ground. And that's it.
Yeah, and then you pieces and put them in another can and put a concrete patch on it and you're done.
Yeah, yeah. And so I talked to the woman who made the official calculations and how bad this can be for the worst bystander. And the result comes out that it was a tolerable but surprisingly high number. And I said, Ruth, how in the world could you get such a number? I mean, it's an acceptable number, but it surprised me that it was even measurable. And it says, she said, well, under the conditions that were put to me on this thing, we are to assume that after this event happens where these guys come in and put a special rocket on there to penetrate, after that happens, it is assumed that nobody moves for 1 year. You know, and everybody stands there, not allowed
they
to
all sit there and watch for a year.
Yeah, you know, I don't know if they bring them pizzas and porta potties, you know. But I mean, that's the kind of stuff we have to do to make a problem that's enough to get some grant money. Otherwise, there's no problem, and you find yourself having to write a report that says, "I guess that solves the problem. Please don't send any more money." And you don't see reports like that often.
And of course, also the even the safety analysis codes that I ran in industry, we would have to use non-physical assumptions. You'd pick, you know, beginning of life, certain parameters of the core, and end of life parameters of the core, and assume the core had all these same things happening at the same time as a big temperature inversion that you might see once every 100 years, and so you can get these very high consequences from these basically non-physical assumptions. Now, those industry codes, I know some of them were written so that you could, let's say, figure out when to turn on your emergency feed water, or when you should, or how many seconds to have for control rod drops. But then the problem becomes is then they get into the public domain and they get applied for these. They get applied as if they're real. As if they're real results.
Well, you know, another thing that drives me crazy is people's inability to read the English language. For example, the report on Chernobyl says very carefully that up to 4,000 people may die an early cancer death over a 70-year period. Well, that doesn't mean that the number is 4,000. That means that that's the upper limit of the number.
Well, and that's a phony because it assumes the so-called LNT assumption that radiation is linearly dangerous all the way down to zero, in which no other substance works like that, and there is pretty good evidence that radiation doesn't work like that.
But LNT is not science. It's just a policy statement.
Well, the LNT, and I know we talked about this on a previous podcast, that the LNT was an artifice that was developed, as I recall, back in the late 40s, early 50s, and kind of took a life of its own. The regulators needed something to base their regulations on, and they had, of course, some data at very high doses, and they extrapolated down to zero so they could make their regulations. But again, it kind of took on a life of its own, and people started talking about it as if it were real.
Well, not only that, but the idea, and I've heard people say it in the game, that, you know, I wouldn't know how to regulate if we couldn't. It would make it much more complicated if we didn't use a linear assumption like that. The linear makes the calculations easier. Well, no other toxin in the world is treated that way. the way they're all treated is that if it's above a certain concentration or level or whatever it might be, then you got to regulate it, and if it's below that, you don't. That's the way everything else works. And if you look at the reports that recommend that we use the LNT assumption, they say that there is no evidence, no scientific evidence that supports this, but that it's just prudent to do so. And that's a really dangerous concept that the nuclear people have gotten into, that we haven't got enough dangerous assumptions here to work with, but it's prudent to keep assuming things that aren't valid, might be, and therefore that'll give us, we'll put some more safety on. And who can object to putting more safety on? And the problem is that safety is not an independent variable. Temperature is, pressure is. I can decide to run a plant at a higher pressure or a higher temperature, and I know exactly what to do and how much of it to do to create that. But safety is an emergent property, and it depends on the training of the personnel and the quality control and the material and a whole bunch of things like that. You cannot add 38% more safety to a plant by deciding to do it. It just is not valid engineering practice. It doesn't work. And moreover, for example, this new European pressurized water reactor, which the EDF people are bragging is safer than the other plants, they're only 10 to the 4th chance of getting an accident, and theirs are 10 to the minus 6th, a completely meaningless concept. But what they do then is they put in a core catcher. They assume the core is going to melt, and then they put a refractory shield below that to divert the stuff into the basement so they can play with it when they get it down there. One of the problems they're running into is that they can't assure that they can keep the core molten, which seems to me to show what your problem is right there. But if you look in the real world, only once was a large plant equipped with a core catcher. And Al Amorosi tacked that in at the last minute, and it vibrated and broke loose and ended up by cutting off some of the flow to the core, leading to some core meltdown. It didn't escape to the public any more than the TMI did. But we have one case of with a core catcher, and that led to meltdown. We've got 450 cases without a thing, and there is no evidence of a need of a core catcher, even in the case of Three Mile Island, where the core did, in fact, melt. 10 to 20 tons of molten core slumped to the bottom of the vessel and sat there, which is the initiator for the China syndrome. And this thing did indeed start to head for China. And how far did it get? 3/8 of an inch. And now they say that a step of 1,000 miles begins with one step, but 3/8 of an inch is a pretty small fraction of 8,000 miles.
Yeah. Now, there are, of course, current design reactors that, while they don't have core catchers, their sumps are designed such that basically if you were to flood the sump, you'd be able to keep the core cool. But that's more of a preventative device.
Yes, but what it does is if you put in a device, any device, that device itself or procedure or whatever, it opens up new opportunities for something to go wrong. And if you're putting in something for which there is no need, then all you're doing is making the plant less dangerous, having less safe, because you've just as it actually happened, you have an opportunity to create a problem that didn't exist if you didn't put that stupid thing in there in the first place.
Well, now, these, of course, I was talking about is just the sump design itself. It's not an actual device. It's something they just they kind of, if you will, you know, made it a different dimension. But yes, you're correct. The more pipes you put in, the easier it is to stop up the drain.
Well, and the idea that any one variable in a very complicated system should trump all others. We've suckered in on that a number of times. We said that the worst thing in the world that could happen to this country is if the commies get ahead of us. And so we had guys that were fighting the commies over in Afghanistan under a very clever fellow named Osama bin Laden. And so we proceeded to arm and train his guys because they're fighting the Russians, and that's the most important variable in the world at the moment, right? And then in the same way we go down, security becomes all important, and you start doing things for security. One of the things they did, for instance, in an early day was decide that, gee, people could get into these various compartments in the reactor system and cause trouble, and so they could lock them up separately so that you would minimize the damage that a saboteur could do. And, of course, if you lock something up, if it's going to be secure, you don't want very many people to have the key. So now you got a problem on a Sunday night, and you want to get into that compartment and fix whatever's going wrong. And the guy who's got the key is home, and his teenage daughter is on the phone. And, you know, you've made a plant less safe by putting so much emphasis on one variable that you trump engineering good sense.
It's really hard to make this clear to people outside nuclear that every time you add parts, even if it's parts that aren't moving, you have added the potential for something new to go wrong that you didn't think about. Now, it's not always a bad thing when the parts that you're adding are necessary, but when you're adding parts that really aren't necessary, that you don't get any significant benefit from, for example, the core catchers, now you have things that you can say, okay, what can go wrong with that? Well, maybe they can break. Maybe they're welded in place and the welds will wear out over, you know, some time over the lifespan. Now you have to go in and inspect them at some period. You know, somebody has to put a camera in there and take a look at it. And that adds expense to the thing. Okay, well, it's not a lot of expense in any one instance, but over the life of the plant, you're basically making the electricity that the public gets the benefit from more expensive, and you're adding dollars that they have to pay for their electricity that you're not getting any net benefit from. You're just compounding the things that can go wrong. You're putting more people in charge of, you know, how do we do the inspections? How do you check these welds? You know, what do we know about welds and their failure rates and how they react under radiation, this, that, and the other? They're very, very safe compared to other methods of putting a reaction together, but you're adding extra parts in here that you're not getting any net benefit from. You're increasing your inspection expense. You're increasing the possibility of wear out for stuff that you're not actually using.
Now, that's exactly right. Sometimes, though, the effect is even in more obvious than that. I understand that the Finnish reactor has just set back its completion date, I think it was a couple of years, on
that's
the,
right.
the fact of putting this, trying to put this triple containment on there, and they're having a lot of trouble doing it, and so that they're just running the cost way up on the thing. They should be putting their efforts into simplifying the plant, not thinking up ways to make it more complicated, because the simpler a plant is, the fewer chances there are of something going wrong. At Three Mile Island, when they had 900 alarms going off in a fairly short period of time, that doesn't add to the safety because of the fact that they've got all those various pieces of machinery yelling at you to do something. You know, Kelly's absolutely right. The simplest possible plant is the one that is going to be the one that's going to be safer probably in the long run, so long as you've got everything that's necessary and nothing more.
Yep,
and of course, that's
safer.
The theory behind things like the ESBWR and the AP1000 is to try to have gravity feed. And in fact, I remember reading the infamous UCS document claiming that, oh, the EPR is the best one because it has the most bells and whistles, and these other ones don't have these same bells and whistles. And I was thinking, but if those simpler devices prevent those other things from happening, then you don't need the extra bells and whistles. You're just gold plating.
Well,
yep.
But you're adding expense, and remember, one man's expense is another man's revenue. All of those bells and whistles that the UCS likes, they know that those things are going to add cost to the plant and make them less competitive and less likely to be built in wide numbers.
Well, and in the process, they're all playing that game. So in the process, the argument that we can't afford to build another nuclear plant is strengthened, you know, and if we finally end up, I think the ultimate irony will be when we're building plants that are coal-fired because the nuclear plants are said to have a waste problem, you know, and nuclear doesn't have a waste problem, and coal definitely does, and somehow or other you put the word clean in front of coal, and that makes it kosher, you know.
Well, one of the problems that we have with our regulation system is that our regulators are by law told that they cannot think about anything other than nuclear safety. They cannot make the evaluation that if they delay and make it so hard to build nuclear that the alternative is to build coal, they still feel, hey, we didn't cause any nuclear accidents. Of course, we killed a lot of people from breathing coal dust, but...
Well, that's the same. Yeah, that's exactly right. That's the same kind of problem that FDA has. I was talking to them one time about this business of approving certain health procedures, and I said that you guys have a tremendous incentive not to say something is safe and then have that turn out to be a wrong answer, and yet nobody can blame you if you hold back, you know, approving something for another year or two or three. And these procedures, these health procedures, they're all put forward on a basis that they're going to save a certain number of lives per day or per year. And those guys are dying in order to keep the other option looking safe. You know, it's there's no win in that thing.
One thing, I know we were talking in the beginning about, of course, scientists dreaming up the China syndrome and things like that, but one thing that I did notice is that actually even before nuclear power, there was a lot of media stirring up fear of radioactivity. If you looked at the 1930s Flash Gordons and some of these things, you'd have radium mines and mutant men and things. A lot of the things that made it into the popular culture much later on when nuclear power was actually implemented.
Well, yes and no. In 1895, when X-rays were first discovered by Rentgen, and then radioactivity shortly thereafter in the form of radium and so forth, and the public's initial reaction to this was just delighted excitement about, you know, here's a new source of energy. They weren't thinking of power plants, but they were thinking of the energy in radiation and what it does and so forth. And there was a lot of excitement on that, and the FDA had to grab a hold of this guy that was this well-known socialite who was selling radiothor or whatever they called it. It was radium water that he was getting people to drink, and he was drinking, 10,000 and 100,000 times the tolerance level, and finally got in trouble. And that was the FDA's opportunity. They leapt in, made demonized radium and demonized the radiation, which up to that point had been quite a lifesaver in ability to make battlefield X-ray examinations and so forth. But most of the troubles that we have, most of the objections and concerns are not generated by the public. The public reflects some of the stuff back on us that we've sold them. But I think we have to keep in mind that getting a slicker and slicker PR job is not going to solve the thing so long as we don't believe it ourselves. As long as we have regulations that say that we've got to get radiation doses below a fraction of a percent of the normal background that people wander around in every day without worrying about it, as long as we're doing that, the assurance that everything is just fine isn't going to be bought by anybody with any sense.
Right. One of the things that we don't help people understand is that whole concept of the dose makes the poison. That person, I can't remember his name off the top of my head.
Paracelsus?
No, I'm talking about
Paracelsus was the 1540. That was the guy. The dose makes the poison.
No, what I'm trying to think of is the guy who was drinking all the radium water, who did in fact have some health problems. That the fact that he got sick didn't make it that radiation was dangerous. That much radiation was dangerous.
Right.
And Marie Curie, who famously died an early death at age 62 from radiation-related illnesses. I mean, that woman isolated radium from tons of uranium in an unheated shack that was had enough radioactive material that the walls actually glowed. She went out to the field and did those battlefield x-rays in unshielded conditions. I mean, she was heavily exposed. She still lived to be 62 years old, but her dose rate was, or her lifetime dose was probably in the hundreds of rem.
Yeah, well, what's his name? Taylor was the original radiation.
Lauriston Taylor?
Lauriston S. Taylor, yeah. And he would say that, you know, he says, I can take 100 or more Rentgens a year if it's spread out a bit. If I get it instantaneously where the body doesn't have a chance to react in time, then it's worse. But he says, I get as much as 100 rad in a year, and he says it does not give me any problem. He died, if you may remember, at the age of 102.
You know, one of the things that I have noticed over the years, and Ted, I'm not trying to be insulting here, but quite a few of your colleagues live to be ripe old ages, people who were pioneers in this nuclear business. I once tried to add the ages to all the people in the photo at the Fermi 1 reactor.
Oh, sure.
And most of them seem to be in the late 80s to all the way up to 100.
Well, I remember I visited Taylor shortly before his 100th birthday, and he had a slight limp, and he apologized for this limp. He said he had been playing touch football with his grandchildren, and he said, they didn't like to run around on the grass. They liked to do it on rollerblades on asphalt, and so they were playing touch football on rollerblades on asphalt, and one of the kids got carried away and tackled him. And his wife said, "Oh, Lori," she says, "you've got to remember you're not 90 anymore." That was a great line. I'd like to hear that myself someday.
Were his grandchildren by any chance in their 50s?
I guess they must have been, yeah. Can you picture the scene?
Yes, I can.
Yeah, he said my doctor just shook his head when I told him the story.
That's priceless.
I think what it goes back to is Al Weinberg's concept. He didn't invent it, but he exploited it, the idea of the Faustian bargain, and the idea that all of the common engineering wisdom that you would apply to any other problem, it just isn't adequate for nuclear. And that, you know, this is a sort of a magic. I compare it to the kind of stuff that, what's her name? Helen, the anthropologist.
Helen Caldicott.
No, the gal who was, she was president of Margaret Mead. She used to tell the kids, in the 60s and 70s, that, you know, the future is another world. Your parents have no experience in that world. The experience that they get in this world is not going to be any help. Their advice is not applicable to you. You know, you've got to learn a whole new ball game. Your parents and the older people are just not in a position to advise you because their wisdom is not going to be adequate to tackle the problems of tomorrow. And it's that sort of word that was put out on nuclear power, you know, that on nuclear phenomena of all kinds. And what you would normally do with in any situation to solve it, that's not going to be adequate for nuclear. You know, nuclear is special, and nuclear. I remember talking to a reporter, and who was worrying about minor uranium miners that were dying from uranium mining. And the fact A is the uranium miners did not have a higher than average death rate, or higher than average cancer rate, but she was assuming that they were. And I said, but don't you realize that a uranium miner, like any miner, has a greater chance of being crushed to death than in a mine failure of some kind than but dying of cancer. And she said, oh, that's not the same thing at all. You know, being crushed to death is just ordinary death, but being killed by radiation is somehow worse than being crushed to death. You know, it's that.
I still remember in one of my textbooks that we have molecular death. We not only kill you, we kill your molecules.
Oh, yeah.
I'm sorry, that's not funny.
It's amazing how, you know, I feel like in that movie, The Princess Bride, you know, well, if somebody dies from cold, they're only mostly dead, or they're holistically dead, but you're much more dead if you're killed with nuclear.
Well, that goes also to the Helen Caldicott argument about how it wrecks your DNA, you know. And it passes down from generation to generation, you know, which is just nuts.
It is nuts because, you know, there have been a lot of studies of the Hiroshima and Nagasaki victims, and there have been none evidence of any genetic effects from even those massive doses. Now, one of the things that's I did want to talk to you, Ted. I know that you and I are both great admirers of Admiral Rickover. But wasn't he one of the people who, like Weinberg, tried to set up nuclear as something extremely special that only the anointed priesthood could operate?
Well, he certainly was one that set extremely high standards and took the attitude that because of people's attitude toward nuclear, a nuclear accident would not be measured by the number of deaths, you know. I mean, if you killed two guys in a nuclear accident, it would be in the headlines all over the world for weeks, you know. And that being so, that, you know, we've got to, while it's, and particularly because it was so new, we've got to make sure that we just have extraordinarily high standards. But he never made any claims about how bad a reactor accident was going to be. He was just saying that it was held in such awe in the public's mind, and the public would jump so fast at something happening. And I think, unfortunately, that's true. I mean, I think that's the way we've all played it. It just really bothers me that nuclear people always start out and say, of course, we got a lot of problems and we're going to have to make these plants safer. I say, wait a minute, safer than what? We haven't killed anybody. We haven't hurt anybody. How do you get these safer than that? Why do we have to make them? You know, of course you want to make them as safe as you can. But to start out and say that nuclear, compared with everybody else, that somehow or other we have the burden of making the plants safer and that they're not safe enough now by implication, why do we make that kind of a statement? I think it's simply not valid.
Well, the late Bert Wolf of General Electric, I liked one of his phrases. He used to talk about what he called the ice cream reactor, that somehow, you know, unless the thing was fueled with ice cream, that and of course he was saying it in a very disgusted manner, why was this industry alone have to come up with an ice cream reactor, whereas coal could just pump out whatever, and even gasoline. I still remember reading the memoirs of Captain Von Trapp, the guy from The Sound of Music. He died of lung cancer, and he was not a smoker. It was from all the gasoline fumes of such long periods on the old World War One submarines. Gasoline causing cancer is somehow considered different than, you know, a 100 rem dose or something like at Hiroshima.
Well, I remember watching the bicentennial celebration, 1976, when they had the fireworks right outside of New York City. They were doing all the fireworks, and this big, thick pall of smoke was drifting over the city. And, you know, fireworks have strontium and barium and all kinds of rough stuff in them, you know. And this big, thick cloud was drifting over New York City. Nobody bothered to make any calculations or even make any qualitative comment that this might have been a problem. You know, we don't even think about such things, you know.
Well, think about...
They collected any kids' baby teeth after that to find out what their exposure was.
Yeah. Hey, well, think about Gulf War I, and remember how everybody was talking about the Gulf War syndrome, and it must have been caused by those depleted uranium bullets. And you look at the pictures, and there was 150 oil fields that were burning, being set afire, and the air was black.
Oh, yeah, I remember. And there's sure a lot of foul stuff in raw oil, including a lot of radon, incidentally. Yeah, when they first set some standards as to how what they were going to accept when the ships came back from the Project Crossroads, you know, from the atomic bomb tests with the Navy, and they set some numbers about how much contamination would be okay. And the first ship started coming in, and sure enough, they were way over spec. And everybody was all panicked about what are we going to do with these contaminated ships. And somebody got the bright idea of measuring the smokestacks of the ships that had never been there. And, you know, oil has a lot of radioactivity in it. It comes up out of the ground, you know. And it turned out that the ships that had never been to Crossroads were over the spec. And, you know, it's that way that if it's got a nuclear tag on it, then somehow or other it's particularly bad. The one I like is that radiation is spooky. You can't see it or smell it or taste it. You can't tell it's there until it's too late. And, of course, the fact is that nothing, absolutely nothing, is easier to detect than radioactivity. We can get it down to the single atom level. You know, we don't know how to get any more. It's easier to detect than any other kind of a contaminant, you know. But somehow they make that a problem. We've done that, and I think we got to get out of that business of finding that we've got a collection of problems that we're working on, and everybody else has machinery that works. You know,
I was just wondering if part of it also, besides of course the regulatory aspect to bring some sanity to, also some of the projects like the Hyperion or the Pebble Bed. I even remember back when the Canadians had the Slowpoke, which was supposed to be a reactor used for apartment buildings or district heating, bringing nuclear power closer to the public imagination, that it's not some big giant thing that's out there that you need all these guards around and these wonderful Jedi Knights to run, that it's something that can be a friend to your neighborhood.
Well, that's one of the things that I've tried to advocate. I really believe that nuclear reactors can be made extremely simple to operate. I tell people often that the most boring job on board a submarine is the reactor operator position. And I have always disagreed heartily with Weinberg's assertion that we needed to build, you know, these nuclear islands with isolated priesthoods operating the plants and sending their electricity all over the country. I mean, he wanted to build places where there was like 10,000 megawatts of power being produced in one place, which, as the Japanese have shown, is not exactly the best reliable way to go.
Well, that seems to work well. I was just going to say, it economically seems to work well in places like Korea or China, where they need to add large amounts of capacity in short periods of time. But just this whole thing, I always wondered if the reason people accepted something like, let's say, gasoline, which is carcinogenic, is because they personally use it, they see a benefit from it. I often sometimes would joke with people that if, you know, you tasted your toast and it's like, oh, this toast tastes awful, it's those coal electrons again, I wish they'd put the nuke back online. You know, the fact that we don't have the fact that nuclear does not have that kind of tangible, unique personal impact in the public's lives. I often wonder if that's part of the reason that it is so easily demonized or exploited. Or
well, I think one of our problems is that a question that, that the NEI has as a matter of policy refused to answer honestly is how bad could it be? What they only talk about is probabilities. And so they tell, you know, that those clowns from the Woodrow Wilson School that came down with a fuel pool accident that kills 518,000 people, and they spread that all around the Congress and everything, and oddly enough, people were perturbed. So they go to the reporter, goes to NEI, and says, what about this? And NEI's answer is, that is a highly improbable scenario, which translates to say we don't intend to kill a half a million people very often. And that's just not an adequate answer. Oh, and to say
I find that very reassuring.
Even something when you're talking probability, I remember there, what was it, in statistical mechanics, there is a finite probability that in Florida our giant swimming pool at the association can freeze over. You know, the atoms can suddenly align, but the probability is so low that, of course, in practicality, it's impossible. And so it's not a bad thing to say it's impossible. And if somebody brings up some probability, it's like the...
Well, I think it's important to note that certain things, certain events, are demonstrably impossible. I mean, you can put up a gas stove under a frying pan, and you can assume that if you get it hot enough, it's going to burn up the frying pan, you know, but it doesn't. It simply doesn't, and you can calculate that it won't. And if you've got a situation where you can calculate something can't happen, if you put the real melting points in and the real release rates and so forth and so on, you can demonstrate not that, you know, the old curve that they used to talk about where you take frequency of accidents and death rate from accidents, if you want to call it that, and you make a straight line that goes up to infinity, then if you're willing to go to a low enough probability, you can kill everybody. You know, and things simply don't work that way. And it's back right after Three Mile Island when Chauncey Starr and all those other guys put out that story about the practical consequences, and it turns out that sure enough, you do find that there is a limit to these things, that line doesn't go up forever. You know, if you have 100 people on an airplane and the airplane is in danger of crashing into the Atlantic Ocean, assuming it doesn't hit a cruise ship, there are only 200 people that can die. You know, it doesn't go up to a million people, no matter what probability you assume on it. So I think that business of answering those questions in terms of probability, A, are not convincing, because people know that highly improbable things happen. You know, every car bridge hand that you get is highly improbable, you know. And certainly nobody could calculate a very high probability for all the crazy things that went on at Three Mile Island, and yet it happened. And if you don't look at it that way, but you do like we did on that science paper, and say, forget about all the scenarios. What's the worst thing that can be, what's the worst consequence that you can have in a nuclear accident? And the first thing is, well, you could have the core melt. Okay, let's assume it melts. What else? We can have the containment punched open. You know, somebody can blow a hole in the containment. Okay, we'll give you that. How bad can it be? And it turns out that that's not a difficult thing to calculate if you're calculating like an engineer in the real world rather than speculating with a scientist. And if it turns out that something calculates that it can't happen, then that's what we ought to tell people. And the fact of the matter is that we've done that, and we've published it in Science Magazine with two anonymous peer reviewers that science picked, that we didn't have anything to say about, and it was authored by 19 members of the National Academy of Engineering, who were guys like Ken Davis and you know, people like that were top people in the field, And it says it can't happen. We publish that article. Nobody rises up and says it's wrong. The only guys that argued about it were Brenner and those guys arguing that we didn't assume the LNT. They said, of course, the probability that any one person gets a high dose is not very great. But you got to realize that there are going to be millions of people exposed to this cloud, you know. And if a million people passes, you know, the cloud passes over a million people, you know, you can show you got a problem. But that's a phony
problem.
Even
a cloud theory. Even the cloud theory can only go one of two ways. You have this cloud of massive radioactive material and no wind, so it sits right there where it's released, in which case you shelter the people that are closest to it because you don't want them out moving around in it, and very few people are exposed. Or you have this cloud and you have wind that will move it. So now you have a whole bunch of people exposed to it only very briefly, and then it's gone. It disperses.
Oh, but
so
Kelly,
you
forget. Kelly, you forget the what is it? In reactor safety, they always talk about what they call it, the Pasquale F and G, where it's an inversion that it, shall we say, optimizes the. It takes the basically literally lifts the stuff out of the reactor, goes over. It doesn't go to like some small village. It of course will go over Los Angeles and drop on Los Angeles.
Yeah, except that you know,
but real weather doesn't act like that.
No, but when you put the numbers in, the first thing you find is that the radioactivity doesn't even get out of the containment. You know, when Chernobyl happened, we told people the difference between Chernobyl and Three Mile Island was that Three Mile Island had containment. You know, and the implication was that inside that containment was a Chernobyl itching to get out. And the fact of the matter is that the data shows that even a containment with a hole in it, after it passes over a lot of steam and water and cold steel, very little gets out. And they did experiments at Idaho in which they opened up the containment slot bigger and bigger, and they couldn't get any iodine out, even when the containment slot was opened way up the full way. You can't get the iodine out because it's in a windstorm of water and air and cold steam and cold steel, and it just doesn't get out. Now, if you're talking about measuring a single atom any place in the world, the single atoms go all over everywhere, and we can still measure and define atoms that are left over from the Chinese nuclear test, for instance, you know, but it's so far behind, below background that it just simply is meaningless, harmless in terms of human health.
One of the things I remember very clearly is I've had a guy on my show who was at the borax experiment where we literally blew up a reactor.
Right.
And,
intentionally.
And he was one of the technicians that went around and picked up the pieces of the reactor and gathered them up so they could figure out exactly what happened and where how high the power level went and all that stuff. Now, I interviewed this guy just about, a few months ago. And so he's about maybe 88, 89 years old. And he picked up the pieces of an exploded reactor without any shielding, by the way.
Yeah.
Yeah, the space reactor program also, they blew up a lot of reactors, and they were, of course, they were different than the reactors that are used for the light water reactors, but again, the same thing. The material just doesn't travel. Something about uranium being heavy and dense or something, and I don't know.
Yeah, that and it being in the form of uranium oxide, so it's already fully oxidized and not particularly absorbable.
Well, a guy just came out with a book called Plutonium, the Most Dangerous Material in the World. And how do you define the most dangerous material in the world? I mean, how many people have died from plutonium poisoning? Zero.
Oh, it's funny you mentioned that. I actually got into an argument once with a health physicist who put something like that in his paper. And we went back and forth and back and forth. And finally, because I kept asking him, I said, well, do you drop, do more people drop dead quicker? And he was like, well, no, but it goes to certain parts of the bone more than other elements. And I said, well, but then what does that do? And then I said, well, does your leg fall off faster, you know? And we went back and forth, and it would just, it was almost an exercise in futility, even some of the folks in our community, that somehow plutonium is this fearsome thing, even though there are far many more chemicals and compounds that...
The fact is that people have been looking for examples of guys that have been killed by plutonium, and they can't find it. You know, there have been a few accidents with fume hoods, stuff being blown up in labs and so forth, and people have inhaled a big slug of it. And most of those guys are still alive, and this happened over 50 years ago, you know. And they're literally, I've seen this authoritatively, that literally no one has been shown to be life-shortened in any way from plutonium, even though we put about 6 tons of it in the air during weapons testing.
Right. We exploded several hundred weapons between us and the Russians in the atmosphere before we went into underground testing.
Yeah.
And, of course, only a portion of the plutonium in those bombs actually exploded. The rest was dispersed widely throughout the atmosphere.
Well,
but
everyone...
do you guys expect to believe that water is deadlier than plutonium?
That's true. If you immerse yourself in it for a mere 6 minutes.
It kills more people.
It does.
The EPA would ban water if somebody invented it today. On that note, I do have to sign off. I am pulling an all-nighter to get back from mid-shift. Our mid-shift ended this morning, but I want to make sure to be able to talk to everyone. Huh?
You're turning into a pumpkin?
I'm turning into a pumpkin. But it's been great talking to everyone. Rod, Kelly, Ted, I hope everyone and their families have a great Thanksgiving.
Yep, same here.
Thanks for joining us, Robert.
Robert, I'm so glad you could join us. It's always a treat to talk with you.
It's always great to talk to everyone also, and it's always nice of you, Rod, to invite me to the podcast.
All right, take care, Robert.
Thanks.
Happy Thanksgiving.
Thanks. Bye.
You know, seriously, though, that last point is an interesting one, because I'm sure we can get statistics. I know we can get statistics on people killed by water, right, because there are a lot of drownings. But if you say, how do you judge how serious, how dangerous a thing is, does it really make sense to come up and say the most dangerous thing in the world is something that's being handled in tonnage lots and has never killed anybody? You know, and I'm sure there are statistics on arsenic and on mercury and a whole bunch of those things where they're actually killing people in the real world. It just doesn't make any sense to claim that plutonium is dangerous if it isn't hurting anybody.
Well, there were a few people that got killed by plutonium, but only when the plutonium was brought together in a very special configuration and dropped over a city. And at that point in the discussion, I made a button-pushing error and cut off my guest. So with that rather abrupt ending, Atomic Show 115 came to an end. And now a word from Cameron Riley, the owner, CEO, and chief floor sweeper for the Podcast Network.
Hi, folks. This is Cameron Riley from the Podcast Network, here for a short but a special and important announcement. We're launching the first ever TPN pledge drive. Now, for those of you that live in countries where you have public radio like NPR in the United States or Triple R in Australia, you'll probably be familiar with the concept of pledge drives. It's basically where they ask the audience to contribute some money to help cover the running costs and help keep independent media running. Now, these are usually radio stations that aren't funded by corporate advertising dollars, and TPN is very much the same. Over the last 4 years that we've been running TPN, I've pretty much funded it out of my own pocket. We've taken bits of advertising here and there, which has helped from time to time, but we've never really taken much advertising. Advertising in podcasts is still a rarity. And with the current financial crisis and the way that advertisers are pulling back online, I don't expect it to be something that's really going to take off over the next year. So what we're going to be doing now is asking you to make voluntary donations to help support independent media. Now, the way that we're doing this is using PayPal as a donation mechanism, and I've put up a blog post that has links to the donation buttons. You can find that at tpn.thepodcastnetwork.com/pledge, and that's spelled P-L-E-D-G-E for those of you that are hard of spelling. And basically the idea is that you can contribute some funds to TPN, which I'll then be able to use to keep the doors open, keep the servers running, and keep the indie media happening. Now, we've been experimenting with this on the Biography Show over the last 6 months, and it's been very well received and very well supported by the audience. And we found a lot of people are willing to contribute like a monthly donation of a couple of bucks, which is great. And there's some other people that have been willing to throw in one-off donations of $20, $50, $100. I have one listener who's contributing $130 a month. And he basically said, look, I'm just spending that money on DVDs or CDs anyway. And as I tend to listen to all the podcasts on TPN, that's where I feel the money should go. But we're not going to be making donations mandatory. Obviously, it's voluntary. The content will remain free for as long as we can keep TPN running. But I would urge you to give serious thought to the role of independent media in your life versus a world of corporate media. And we all know that corporate media, advertising-funded media, to a large degree, the content is driven by the advertising and what the advertisers want people to see or hear or read. And I feel that independent media, if we want it to grow and be successful over the course of the next few years, we really need to think of alternative models for funding it. And independent media, I think, can and should be funded by the audience. You know, we don't have the cost base of a large media company, but we do have costs. And as I'm sure you know, we spend a lot of time and effort in producing shows for you. And so I think it would be great if we could see an independent media that was entirely funded by audience donations. So there'll be a link to the donation page in the show notes for this podcast, but also you can go up to tpn.thepodcastnetwork.com/pledge. And if you listen to a number of podcasts on TPN, I would urge you to support each of those. There's a box in the sponsorship page there where you can type in the name of the podcast that you're supporting along with how much you want to support. And I'm hoping that this will be enough to keep the doors open at TPN. So thanks for listening, and I look forward to speaking to you soon.
There's a way, a way, such a better way. Today, today. Raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today there's a better way. Ooh, there's a way, such a better way. Today, today. Now raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today there's a better way.
You're listening to the Podcast Network. Listen, learn, evolve.